Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. If you're an actuary, you, like me, probably dread the professionalism continuing education requirement. I think that the best time to satisfy this is in podcast time, while on your commute, while walking your dog, while mowing your lawn, while doing the dishes. Head over to notunprofessional.com, where, for the price of a CAS webinar, you can get content dedicated to continuing education for actuaries, especially professionalism CE. That's notunprofessional.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the Not Unreasonable Podcast. And just before we start, quick plug for notunreasonable.com, where you can get links and notes related to all podcast episodes, today's included. You should also sign up for the mailing list. Why? Because I'm going to start putting together short bits of content every week. I do a lot of research and put a lot of work into these podcasts, and not everything makes it in. So each week, I'm going to send you a note with something that I've observed or heard or read. You'll enjoy it. Sign up at notunreasonable.com/signup. Now on with the show. My guest today is Rich Durr. Rich is an actuary with Nationwide Insurance Company and the Specialty Division. This episode is an idea that Rich pitched me a little while ago, what I'm going to call Not Unreasonable Deep Dives with Rich Durr. This will be our pilot episode. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So the idea this week is to study arbitrage as it exists, I guess, in the financial markets and apply it to specialty insurance. Is that right?
Correct. I found this paper, read through it, and was surprised at the relationships that I found between arbitrage and specialty insurance.
And we'll put a big link up to that paper, of course. The paper is called The Limits of Arbitrage by Andre Schleifer and Robert Vishny. This paper what year was it? 1997. So it's a little dated, but maybe the truths are universal.
Yeah, I think it's still very, very applicable to what we do.
Okay, so maybe we can start off with a description of what arbitrage is and in the financial markets and the financial community and kind of how that idea is important, why it's important.
Sure. So you have sort of two definitions of arbitrage that you're working with. You have that textbook definition that we, as actuaries, learned early on when you're looking at CAPM, and it's this idea that you can buy an asset at a low price in one market, sell it in the other, and take advantage of that price difference. You're recognizing the profits immediately, and there's no risk associated with it. Mm. That's not really the reality of how arbitrage works, though. The reality of arbitrage is that when you have this price difference, on one market you borrow the asset to sell, and the other market you borrow money to buy an asset, and now you're holding a position, and you don't actually make money until those prices converge. Mm. And that's important because there's now credit risk involved. You now have to put up capital to hold that position. Mm. So the more realistic definition adds a lot of risk to arbitrage.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time you ever came across this idea, arbitrage, in your life?
Probably the movie Arbitrage.
Okay.
But
I'm not familiar with that movie. I didn't even know there was a movie called Arbitrage.
I think a Richard Gere movie, yeah. Forever ago.
Wow. Do you remember what happened in that movie?
I do not. Okay. But I do know.
Kind of an esoteric concept to put a A-list Hollywood star in front of.
So, yeah, it's a strange concept. Fun word. I really enjoy saying it.
It is. Arbitrage. I agree entirely. Word. I totally agree. I remember the first time I heard it was when I was in university and I was in a finance class. And the professor said, there's this thing called arbitrage. And I had the same reaction. I thought, well, that's fancy. French. Nice. And actually, as I was preparing for this conversation, I looked it up, the word arbitrage, the etymology of it. Where did it come from? It is French, of course. And the root is the same as arbitrator or arbiter, which is to decide. And there's this paper that was written in, like, I don't know how long, 18-something or other, by a French economist about the arbitrage being the decision point, or sorry, the act of making a decision between alternative
investment ideas. In this case, it was where to invest British pounds. And so what was interesting when you first proposed this idea to me, I always had this idea of arbitrage as being in the purest financial conception of it, like you mentioned a second ago, where you can have a riskless or it must be a riskless profit and sort of this platonic ideal of an investment decision. But in its original conception, it was actually just about just picking the best of available options. And so it was a very, very pragmatic kind of idea at first, which is nice because we're kind of coming back to that with this paper. We're really about choosing the best option. And then I think if this paper is in some ways revealing some of the flaws and actually the problems with the way it's conceived of in the finance textbooks.
Exactly. And this paper is getting at the idea that arbitrage, if it was perfect, you would have very efficient markets. And
yeah.
The fact that it's not perfect and because of the structure of how the capital is set up, which we'll get into a little bit, you end up with inefficient markets. And I think that correlates closely with specialty insurance, and it's why we have underwriting cycles, or one of the reasons I believe we have underwriting cycles.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to get into that a little bit more. Let's talk about why arbitrage isn't perfect in the financial markets concept of it.
Sure. So the way, because of how arbitrage is actually set up, the reality of it, where you have to put up capital, let's build a structure around it, right?
Sure.
So we have three different parties. We have noise traders. If we're relating to specialty insurance, that would be competitors. Mm-hmm. If you're the arbitrager, it would be like our specialty insurers that I was talking about earlier. And then we would have investors, and that's whoever controls your access to capital. So you have these three different parties, and this is getting into the agency structure of arbitrage. And so now that we have these...
I was going to say agency, in this case, is an important idea because that's the relationship between the actual arbitrageur, which is this, let's call it a guy, if we can be gender non-neutral about it, and it's capital providers. And so you have the people who are going to give him capital, and they're going to say, you do what you need to do, and we don't really understand it. And so there's an agency relationship there in particular.
Exactly. And that knowledge gap is one of the large problems that you're going to have with arbitrage. And it ends up being a issue in specialty insurance as well. You have this knowledge gap difference. But arbitrage ends up not being perfect because if we look at it in a timeline, so at the initially there's this opportunity, there's this mispricing that pops up. At time equals two, the prices, they will hopefully converge. You cash out of that position and everybody's happy, you make money. Mm-hmm. But the reality of it is that the prices might actually diverge. And if the prices diverge, that means the arbitrager is now actually recognizing a loss. They have to put up more capital. They have to recognize that loss. If they don't have the capital put up, you have to go back to the investors and say, hey, look, to just hold this position that we still think can make money, we're going to need more capital.
Mm-hmm. How is capital calculated in this way? Do you know?
I don't know how they decide how much capital
should
be.
Like capital is always related to risk, right? That's a concept that we're pretty familiar with in our business. And I guess that there's a perception that the risk increases as the position goes more negative, which makes sense.
Yeah, you'd have more, I guess there'd be more credit risk there, right? You'd have to come up with more money. So more credit risk,
potential
more
loss is larger,
yep.
Right? If you were to liquidate the position at the wrong time. And I think of if you have... the notional exposure or maybe the immediate exposure to loss goes up, then you're going to have some percentage of capital, I guess, allocated to that. In any case, it seems riskier. It looks riskier. And that's the real core insight, isn't it? When a position goes farther away from where you think it should be, it looks scarier.
Yep. And especially if you don't have that specialty knowledge, you're looking at that position and as the investor, you're going, wait a minute, you're telling me everything's fine, but you're recognizing a loss. Now you're coming to me for more money. And where it gets even more fun is the arbitrager saying, not only that, but the opportunity is actually better right now.
Yeah.
And so we need more capital to go heavier into that position.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty of the arbitrager. And I think that actually relates a little bit to specialty insurance as well.
Yeah. Of course, that sentiment is self-serving.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so, you know, everybody who's ever traded in the financial markets, which is probably a lot of actuaries, recognizes the feeling of when you make a bet and it goes against you and you're thinking, do I need to revise my opinion of what's going on here? And you don't really want to, but now there's this whole truckload of cognitive biases that are pouring all over you here, right? So on the one hand, you have the sunk cost fallacy, right? Just saying, I'm in, you know, and I spent, quote unquote, all this money to get to this position, and why I got to hang on for longer. And that's wrong because you should always evaluate the position based on the profit and loss opportunities in that moment. There's this availability bias to you. So the information that has available right now is like that's going down. So therefore, is it going down? That's fighting against that. It's probably pretty hard to keep your cool in such a position.
Right. And so you're pushing for this and you're saying, I feel like I'm right. So you're pushing for that additional capital to really capitalize on that moment. Mm-hmm. And on the specialty insurance side, I have that same thing where maybe we want to enter into, maybe we're not already in the position, but we recognize a line of business we want to get into. There were some serious losses that had maybe occurred in that line of business in the past, but we think this is the moment that you need to jump in. Is that moment before there's a lot of other competitors, the market's hardened, a lot of people have pulled out because of past losses. A great example that we had of that is if you've heard of these Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac deals that they're doing right now.
Yep, they're buying capital, right? To they're buying reinsurance.
Exactly.
Right, against a systemic issue in the housing market, big downturn in prices, and then they will lose a lot of money. Very classic aggregate deal.
Yeah, so they're bunching up all these mortgages, and everybody's familiar with mortgage-backed securities at this point with, you know, the Big Short movie and
everything.
they're still doing that, but they're like, there's got to be another way to transfer risk, and not surprisingly, a great way to transfer risk is insurance. And so this opportunity's come up where if you partner with the right people, you can get into this business. You buy a default layer rather than a loss layer. So instead of 1 million excess of 1 million, you'd be covering like the 1% to 2% default layer. So as soon as the defaults of that portfolio hit that 1% mark, you're responsible for the losses. Mm-hmm. The market, the number of competitors are actually restrained on that line of business. There's only so many competitors that can get into it. There's a process to get involved. And once you're in...
By this, do you mean the reinsurers or Fannie and Freddie?
The reinsurers. Okay. The Fannie and Freddie control the number of reinsurers that get into it.
Right.
So we thought it was a great opportunity. We went to our upper management to try to pull them in and get into this. And that financial crisis loss is still hanging over everybody's head. It's very scary. And we had other issues. Credit risk is a huge issue, especially for a company like Nationwide. It has the whole financial side. But as my job as the actuary, I felt it was my job to bridge that gap. I think one of the most important jobs of an actuary is bridging that knowledge gap, saying, look, I did the analysis. Here's what I needed to do, and here's what we should be doing, and trying to convince them to jump into the line of business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think the key link here between the arbitrage idea and the specialty, if I'm thinking this right, is the idea of expertise and the idea of it not being obvious what you should do or how to make money in this line of business to people who aren't in it. Is that right?
Exactly. And so the arbitragers have that specialty knowledge, specialty insurance. You also have that knowledge. And what gets interesting, the link actually is stronger than just that. It's also, I think, related to the underwriting cycles we see. Mm-hmm. So the hard markets that you see.
Cyclical.
Yeah, exactly.
Underwriting profitability is cyclical, as is the profitability of the stock market, I guess.
Well, the idea is for an arbitrager, your biggest opportunity happens whenever there's that largest convergence or divergence in the prices. And that's when everybody's the scaredest to get in. And in specialty insurance, it's sort of the same thing. You have that big loss and it's scary to jump into it, but that might be your best opportunity to make money. Mm-hmm. And I got to be careful when I say that, right? You don't want to just jump in. You have to understand why the losses were there and making sure that it's still a good opportunity, that the market is hardened enough that you can make the money. But having that specialty knowledge is key.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things to me that I'd like to ask you about on that comparison is, with insurance, you're not as constrained about the price that you want to charge, right? And so I just kind of think, as I was kind of pondering this, thinking about where does this comparison fray a little bit at the edges? And one of them I think is maybe that in the stock market you have a price that you're willing to pay, I guess, and you can't quote. Or I guess you can. I guess you can offer a bid for a stock and offer to pay it and just sort of wait around for it to not come in. And I suppose that maybe I'm totally wrong with that, because ultimately in insurance, you're able to, you have a price you think is right, and that price is based on whatever your expertise is, and you can wait around for somebody to give you that price. And then the scary thing for the capital provider is, does this person know what the right price is?
Right, and I mean that is the job of the actuary, right? Is to find that price.
The fundamental analyst.
And what's that?
Like a fundamental analyst.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, in the stock market.
Yep.
Conception of it. So how do the capital providers decide whether to give you money or not?
So that's one of the key assumptions of this paper. Right, it gets into the performance based arbitrage, performance based allocation. What they do is how they decide who gets the capital is they look at the historic experience of the arbitrager. Because the strategies of the arbitrage are so difficult that they don't really understand it, so they'll look at the historic results and say, hey, look, historically you've done great. You're going to get capital. Historically you've done meh. You don't get a lot of capital. But that kind of provides a disconnect, right? Because what you should be looking at is the expected results. It's fantasy football time. So just using that as an example, like if you just used the last year to judge what the players are going to do next year, you're gonna lose. You need to look at what the expected results are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they're making the capital decisions.
Yeah. So the capital providers, as I was reading the paper, one of the key assumptions of their model there is that for the most part, they're coming with an idea, a preconceived notion of who's better or not. They call them Bayesians in this manner. They are more or less updating that idea on past performance. They're saying, if you as an arbitrageur, I'm not developing an opinion of your strategy, but merely developing an opinion of you as a practitioner in this business based on your track record. Doesn't seem too crazy, right? Except that sometimes, as we were pointing out earlier, the market can move against you. And then what do you do? Because their track record is terrible when they've lost a whole bunch of money.
Right. So that's again, the job of the actuary, the job of the arbitrageur is to go there and convince them that, look, we understand that this went wrong, but we need you to keep providing the capital so we can go harder.
Yeah.
But getting into the performance-based thing, I think that happens on the insurance side as well. You look at maybe not specific to a company or within a division within the company, but you'll look at a line of business and you'll look at the historic results. And this is how you end up with underwriting cycles, right? You have a line of business that has been performing very poorly, and so, well, we're not going to get in that line of business. Well, at some point, everybody says that.
Mm-hmm.
The market starts to harden. Everybody looks and says, oh, look, the market's hardening, and then they get into it, but then you end up getting into it right as it's starting to soften again. So
you buy high and sell low.
Exactly. But by using the historic as your a priori, you're always trailing your best possible results.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing you need to keep in mind when you're in specialty insurance is when you see your opportunity, you really need to jump on it.
Mm-hmm. So do you think is that a flaw in the market, you think, in some way of this sort of misconception or this, I mean, I can only call it a flawed evaluation of performance because you're only looking at their past performance and it is, and I think maybe the key idea of the paper is that there's a fundamental tension between the capital provider's perspective of the profits and the arbitrageur's perspective of the profits. And that really dilutes the potential impact that arbitrageurs can have on the market because their capital providers keep pulling their rug out from underneath them every time they think they have an opportunity. And that enables mispricing or facilitates mispricing, actually.
Exactly. It's what causes the market to be inefficient. The arbitrageurs are expected to make the market efficient, mm-hmm. but if you keep pulling the capital, it ends up being inefficient.
Mm.
And then even the worst case scenario, this gets into gambler's ruin.
Yeah, explain what that is. Yeah.
So the idea is it's not a big deal. You can take forever positions in these as long as you have infinite capital. So gambler's ruin is sort of the same idea. So if you have one guy I'll use a roulette wheel. You're at a roulette wheel and you take the genius strategy that everybody's come up with at some point, right? You put a dollar down on black, you lose, you double it, $2, four, eight, 16, and so forth. You can't lose because at some point you'll eventually win. But the reality of it is unless you have infinitely deep pockets, at some point you're going to run out of that cash.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to the table with $500, you lose a couple times in a row, you go in for that 500, for your pocket, it's going to be empty. And now you have to recognize the loss. And you're not going to be there for whatever the upswing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the same thing with the arbitrageurs, right? You're there, you hold that position, you're putting up capital, waiting for it to improve. But eventually the investors are going to say, well, look, you're not getting any more capital. Now you have to close out that position at a loss, even if you're convinced that the prices are going to converge at some point.
Mm-hmm. And that plays out in the specialty insurance or in the insurance market as you're staying in a line of business, even though it keeps losing you money?
Exactly. Yeah, things are starting to turn. They don't look great. But if you understand the reasons why and you can explain that, you can say, look, I understand it's bad, but let's try to manage this, manage the exposure, because there's a whole other host of reasons why you'd want to stay in the line. But at some point, the market will harden and you don't want to be starting from scratch again. You want to keep those relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to stay in there. You need that capital to continue to write, even if it is you're losing money. You just need to manage that loss. The market turns. And then if you've done it correctly, you have a lot of capital to really go at it right as the market hardens.
It's a little frustrating in some ways, isn't it? Even talking about it, because how do you know? Like, let's say you're a capital provider, and this is one of the key observations in the paper. It's due to the limited information that the capital provider has about what strategy is good and what strategy is bad that they have to behave this way. But the paper doesn't. The paper simply, to me anyway, my reading of it presents it as a problem. Doesn't necessarily say that there's anything we can do about it. You know, it seems like this is just sort of reality of dealing with people with expertise is that you either trust them or you don't. And after some non-specified amount of time, your trust just evaporates. Then you pull the plug.
Yeah, exactly. It's tough. And the truth of it is, like, as the expert, you don't truly know.
Yeah,
either.
Sure.
Especially insurance. Like, I'm confident that I have an idea of what could be happening. Like, we're in a lot of public D&O right now. And the frequency seems to be upticking. And we're trying to get a handle on that. And it's very important that we figure it out, because we don't want to keep taking losses. We're still running profitably, but we need to, you know, figure that piece of it out before it becomes a problem. And we need to make sure we communicate it clearly and everybody understands exactly what's going on. It's it's an interesting problem. It's actually a lot of fun digging into the data and really figuring out what's going on. But it's tough, because I don't actually never become 100% sure if I am right.
In your heart of hearts, do you think that the expertise is undervalued? So do you feel that, for the most part, at least in your experience, that capital providers pull out too early in those situations?
So far, I've lucked out. They've not. They'll stick with you and hold out with you and give you the benefit of the doubt for a good while, which is great, right? They have my back. They trust me, and it takes an entire team to do that. Like, I can't do that alone as the actuary. I have claims that I talk to. They help me with this. I have talked to the underwriters. They help me with this. It's not just the actuary on their own out there. You have a lot of support, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. And so, generally speaking, though, you think that this is you're lucky, or is your experience better, you think, than other folks? Because I guess it comes down to you establishing a reputation over a certain period of time, and others may or may not be able to do that. It's simple as that.
Yeah, I think I would guess that this is the standard, that they're willing to take a chance on things, as long as you have the expert out there. That being said, I was actually pretty new into my role when the Fannie and Freddie Mac stuff came up. Did lots and lots of research. We ended up pulling out of the line of business, and I think that was one of the times where not having that experience of being new to my position kind of hurt me, because the person I was replacing, she had all the relationships with a lot of these people, whereas I was coming in, and I think a lot of it was like, who is this guy? So it can happen. It can result in them pulling the capital out, maybe prematurely. But again, it wasn't just that. There was lots of other things that were happening.
Yeah, right. And it was still, though, a leap of faith for, let's say, you, a young actuary, to make a call. And I think this is another thing that was addressed in the paper, which I found interesting, where they said that the young or the new fund, a new arbitrageur, an inexperienced arbitrageur, in this case defined as somebody without a long track record, has a disadvantage against those with a long track record. And the reason is that capital providers, you know, if you have this, call it lagging indicator of quality, or you're averaging over a shorter time period and you have a big downswing in your profitability, the average with a big negative number in there goes negative pretty quickly. But somebody with a long track record, you're averaging over a longer period of time, you're seeing that they have a larger, more credibility, I guess is the word I'm looking at. And so they have an advantage. There's an incumbency advantage amongst arbitrageurs for attracting capital, because if you've been doing it for a long time, then you are better off.
Yep, exactly. And I think that was exactly what happened in that scenario. It wasn't so much that I had a negative history, is that I didn't have a history.
Absence of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That actually, in my mind, I had something bugged me about that a little bit. And that was that I thought the usual progression for somebody who does well and attracts capital, in particular in the financial markets, but maybe the case in insurance too, is you wind up with a strategic scope creep. And so you wind up doing other things. I went to this talk by, what's his name again? John Paulson, I think, who was a famous financial crisis. I think he might've been in that Big Short book for making a lot of money betting against the housing bubble, right? So betting on the housing downturn, he made it in huge billions of dollars. And I went to a talk he hosted, or he spoke at in 2010, I think. And it was interesting because he got up there and he started talking about how they had gotten into all these new investment ideas, new funds that they'd sponsored. And they have the main fund, which is the one that made all that money. And then they have a gold fund, and they have a tech fund or whatever it was. And I remember sitting there listening to their arguments for kind of why it was amazing that they're doing all this. And I thought, with a gold fund, I was like, that seems to me to be an awful like a fad. Everybody's going into gold because they think that gold's going to spike because inflation's going to spike. There's this pretty simple causal relationship they had there between the monetary loosening of the Fed buying all this stuff and increasing the money supply, or allegedly so, and then inflation, therefore then going up, therefore then the spike in gold prices. That was a big bet he was making. And I was sitting in the audience thinking, what does he know about this? This is a pretty pretty big picture macroeconomic thing, and I was kind of skeptical. And I sort of got this feeling of hubris, sensing it from the audience, that he was somebody who had made a lot of money in something, maybe even lucky, maybe not, I don't know, but had wound up putting a ton of his cash and credibility into this other fund. And it turns out later on it was a terrible idea, and he lost tons of money, and I don't know what he's doing now, but the shine is coming off his reputation because the hubris, you start believing a little bit more of your own press and moving into other things. And so kind of all coming back to this observation from the paper, whereby the experienced manager attracts more capital and has a better track record, I wonder whether there's a feedback loop there, but the experience actually makes them think that they can do more, and then they go and do dumb things, and that actually detracts from the reputation ultimately. What do you think?
No, I think that's definitely true. I was actually listening to a podcast. I wish I could remember the name of the economist. He ends up being looked over pretty commonly. He made lots of great theories, and in 1929, the only thing he's remembered for is in 1929 he said, "Oh, the market's going to plateau." Right. And it crashed, and right. Now he's never remembered. But I think that's definitely something that happens, is you start to believe your own hype, right? You're doing well and you're doing great, so you're trying to do more and more and more, and maybe you're trying to turn things that aren't really opportunities into opportunities, and it's gonna bite you.
Mm-hmm. Does that happen in insurance too?
100% it happens in insurance. I think specifically it would happen in lines that you're already confident in.
Yeah,
You're seeing lots of profits. I want to keep it sort of vague here.
Yeah, sure.
But you're seeing lots of profits in a certain line of business, and you think you know that line. Something changes, and you're very confident you understand why it changed.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that you're wrong, and it doesn't actually turn around. And now you're way behind the mark, and you need to do a lot. Lots of premium, lots of underwriting changes, lots of claims handling changes, and you're trying to get caught up. I think that's something that happens
In your experience, is there a pattern to those mistakes? Is there something that we can learn from, like going into a line of business? What would be a way to do it poorly?
If going into a new line of business?
Sure.
I think it would be assuming that you already know a lot of this stuff.
Mm.
When we get into a line of business, I read a ridiculous amount of material. I track people down. I track down authors and talk to the authors of this stuff.
Describing the risks.
I think if you just listen to the people who are trying to sell you on the product, it's going to sound amazing no matter what you do. So you need to kind of do your own research and really figure that out.
Where do you go? Let's say you wanted to get a new line of business. Where do you find this material? How do you do the research?
So I'll start with the underwriter or the people who brought the idea to us and say, yeah. What did you guys read? How did you guys develop this? And they'll provide me all of their authors.
Okay.
And then from there, when I reach out to other people, it's more of like a chain. I kind of just go down the line and find the people who they're like, oh, you should look at this or you should read this, until I kind of end up with my own opinion of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long does that take?
So for the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stuff, I would say it took me about 4 months of research before I got fully comfortable with it. I don't think I was a fully expert on it, but I thought I had enough to have a good opinion on it.
And that's a line of business for which there's a lot of public information.
Yeah.
Mortgages. But for the typical specialty, and I guess mortgage risk is only specialty in the insurance world.
Yes, yes.
Right? I mean, that's like as mainstream, literally as mainstream as it gets in all other aspects and other parts of finance. But for us, I think it'd be pretty hard to find a big literature on space launches.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to get
so the I'm most. Doing. We're doing something that has to do with some intellectual property stuff that I'm looking to and trying to figure out that stuff. Just to give you an example on that, you recommended that book, Capitalism Without Capital.
Sure.
I was like, listening to random podcasts will sometimes feed into things. And then reading that book, they mention other books. So now I'm digging into those books and reading those.
Mm-hmm.
I have all kinds of papers that I've gathered from them. So again, it's never one source and it's never a consistent source, but I'm always just trying to add to my knowledge because you also never know where things are going to cross over either. Like just randomly something from the mortgage world might end up helping me in the IP world. Who knows?
Yeah. And I guess kind of bringing it back to the idea of the show today, this is the solution to a lot of these arbitrage problems is learn more. Become an expert yourself.
Exactly. It's and not just becoming the expert, making sure you can convince people that you are the expert.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the kind of key ideas here is identifying the profit. And I think of the cost as being, call it maybe one of the reasons why the efficiencies are there, right? So the perfect model of arbitrage is where you can walk in and with zero cost resolve the market, diverge the price in the market, the divergence in the market price against some fundamental value. But in reality, you have all these costs, you have all these frictions in the marketplace. You know, do you have to borrow the capital, and you have to pay brokers, and you have to whatever you have to do, right? And measuring those costs and measuring the potential gain, that's the key analysis, analytical process. In the stock market, that's easy. You come up with a price, right? And you say, we'll look at the market price today or the average price for the last 3 months. There's a difference. Off you go. How do you make the value proposition in specialty insurance? Like, how do you know here's where I can make a lot of money? And how do you measure that? How do you measure the price, I suppose, the price divergence?
So yeah, that's the key part, is where you're going to get your data, right, to figure this out. So if you have the right, what I've learned in specialty insurance, the probably the two most important things are your claims handling and your relationships. So in this case, I'd say relationships is what you'd really need to leverage. You need to go out, you need to talk to the people, and you need to get historic data to see what have they seen in the past, why were they having losses. And get an understanding of that. And if you understand why they have losses, now you can go to your claims handlers and be like, hey, guys, can we do something about this? Mm-hmm. And it's really figuring that out. And then it's paying attention to the market. Who's entering, who's exiting. If you see a line of business where there's a lot of people running away from it, that's the one you want to take a peek at. You want to look at it and see, well, what's going on here? Can we take advantage of this?
Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried and failed to do that?
Yes. Okay. Also, in the intellectual property world, took a shot at it and didn't quite. We had a lot of historic data, just something was different. We couldn't figure out what.
Yeah, about the experience you had wasn't as good. So you went in, and it didn't work out. Is that the story?
Yeah. We had a large data. We take a look at it, and it just, for whatever reason, it didn't perform exactly like we expected it.
Interesting.
To.
And how quickly did you figure that out?
It took a while. We tried to stick to our guns for a while. Yeah. So it probably took 3-4 years before we finally said, all right, we gotta get rid of this.
And of course you stick to your guns, because that's the mantra, right? That's the whole point of being an arbitrageur, is that your discipline, I suppose, is what allows you to stick through the difficult times. And what goes through your head when you have the first data point that comes in and it's not what you think it's going to be? You know, how does your call it your Bayesian evaluation of the system? Walk me through the updating, you know?
Sure. So it's always concerning, and it almost never comes in how you,
sure.
How,
right. Every
the first year is usually not the greatest year. Part of it just because of, you know, you're earning premium. There's not a lot of premium. So you get one claim and it looks terrible.
Yeah.
So it's never overreacting. It's always watching what's going on. And I'd say with specialty insurance, again, the biggest thing is communication. It's talking to your claims. What are you guys seeing? What do you expect to see? And then I'm always checking to make sure that based on what they're saying, I'm seeing it in the data. It's really just this cyclical meeting quarterly and figuring this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much as just doing your standard actuarial approach of saying we ran the numbers through and here's your answer. It's much more involved of communicating with underwriting and claims and getting it really figured out.
How scary is this? Going into something new, I mean, how much do you feel like your budding reputation is on the line for things like this? I mean, how do you mitigate that or that fear maybe?
So it depends on the line. So some of these are coming in. They're really small lines. Okay. I'm not too concerned.
Right.
The Fannie and Freddie stuff, huge exposure. Mm-hmm. I'm very concerned about it. So if that goes wrong, things were going to be very bad. There's a whole lot of loss on the line there. But so it really just depends line to line. And as far as like my reputation, it's you want to get more right than you get wrong.
Yeah.
So it's always in play. It's mm-hmm. getting the big ones right is the most important thing, though.
Well, what would be some circumstances where you would look, just call it big picture? Let's say you're allocating capital to the insurance industry, or you know, you're running an insurance company and you got to figure out a new line to get into. What are some like things you can look for signals that there might be something here before you go to the deep dive?
So for just Are you speaking to like a general overview of the entire industry? What are
like,
you looking
for?
You
got a list of all the lines of business in the United States. What data points do I put in that list to have my dashboard for looking out for opportunities?
So generally, I would say competitors and seeing who's withdrawing from lines.
Interesting.
And that's where I would kind of take a look.
Yeah. And looking for smart ones going in that you think of and dumb ones going out, I guess? Or
mostly just people who are coming out. If people are running from it and
people exiting a market. How do you measure that, though?
We got to read articles, news articles. There's nowhere you can go where you can get a list of everybody who's in a line. So you're reading the articles of saying who's getting into stuff, who's flattening out their exposure on it, and leveraging those relationship with brokers, with reinsurers, and seeing, you know, hey, who's doing this?
Mm-hmm.
How many people are you guys seeing people entering this line, and sort of leveraging that relationship.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that answer is that your answer wasn't look at how the line's performing, actually.
No, true. Yeah.
Right. It's more about evaluating the perception of how that line is performing by people's movement of capital.
Right. It's getting back to the paper of, I don't want to rely on the historic experience. I want to look at the expected experience. So find a line where there's opportunity and then look at the expected rather than just looking at the historic.
And in that case, you're looking at your competitors, right, as a potential arbitrageur, and they're all doing that too. Is everybody in the insurance industry a supposed arbitrageur? Because I think that you could very easily slip down the slope of, well, everybody in the investment community thinks they know what they're doing. They all think they have expertise. They all think they're making money. They all think they're picking the right stocks. Are they all arbitrageurs? Is there anything that's not an arbitrageur?
So, yeah, this also gets back to the paper where a lot of financial theories rely on the fact that everybody is an arbitrager, but the reality is there's only a couple of firms that really specialize in arbitrage.
Okay.
And I feel like specialty insurance, it's not quite that way. Pretty much every large insurer has some sort of division that does specialty insurance.
Sure.
But it's sort of that same idea of there's only a handful of people who can actually take advantage of these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And that's because they have special expertise. But I think at least in the insurance markets, everybody wants to believe that they understand the price of the business they're getting into because of their expertise. What do you think would be the difference between a standard line and a specialty line then?
So that's a good question. So for standard lines, the way I define standard lines is usually the amount of data that you have.
Okay.
And so this is also why I think a lot of the standard lines don't really have market cycles anymore. So if you're looking at personal auto, homeowners, you have so much data out there that it's hard to come up with
hard to screw it up.
Yeah, it's hard to come up with a very wrong answer. You might be wrong and might lose like a point or two here or there, but it's very hard to mess it up a lot. And the biggest thing in standard lines is actually price. You need to shave expense dollars. You need to figure out how to get more efficient. It's less about getting the answer right. And there's a lot of people who do standard lines because a lot of people do it. You end up with not having market cycles, right? This gets back to the paper where they're discussing the glamour versus value stocks, right? So if you're an arbitrager, you can try to take advantage of that, but it's such a long-term play that you end up running out of capital before you can close out of that position. But eventually all investors catch on to it, and then they make that play, and then the market becomes efficient. And market efficiency in the insurance world is not having an underwriting cycle. Mm-hmm. It's just you're charging what you should be charging. And I think that's the idea in standard lines is you have a lot of people who now know what they're doing, and now you don't really have as many market cycles. You still have some cat shock that causes some cycles. But for the most part, underwriting cycles have sort of died out in the standard lines.
You know, I think of in the standard lines as actually in some ways being less competitive than specialty lines because there the barriers to entry are almost higher. And this is kind of where I feel like I don't have a good metaphor in the financial markets for – there's two ways in which I think that the comparisons, maybe they break down. See what you think. So one of them is in standard lines, tends to be dominated by a few quite large carriers, right, who have enormous expertise and for whom competing against them is madness, right? So you're saying, hey, I'm going to be a preferred auto carrier in California, and I'm going to go up against Progressive and Geico and State Farm and Travelers and be like, you must be out of your bleeping mind, right? How could you possibly beat them? You're like, well, I have all the data. They're like, well, there's a you're misunderstanding exactly about what you need to do to capitalize on that data and what data you can get for free and what you can pay for and what data they have already, you know. So there's almost this clash of the behemoths, which prevents everybody from getting in there.
Exactly. I mean, I worked for 6 years at Geico.
Yeah.
They are very good at what they do.
Yeah.
I can't imagine many people are going to be able to step in and knock them off the perch. Mm. People always tend to bring up like, oh, well, Google's very good at data. They can be very efficient. They could step in and do this. But I don't even know if it would be worth it. The margins on personal auto are so tight at this point mm-hmm. that I don't know if it would make sense for a big player like that to try to disrupt it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the Progressives, the Geicos are very good at what they do. It would be tough to compete against them.
And maybe they're doing such similar things that there emerges quite a natural equilibrium in that market of price level. You know, I think about history here where, call it 100 years ago, the insurance, well, maybe 60 years ago or 70 years ago is better, where the insurance cycles were a bit more muted, as I understand it, because prices were basically fixed. And you couldn't diverge because you had a rating bureau that was saying, here's the price, and then you compete on, God knows, commissions, usually, in that case. And so companies could go bust, but it wasn't because there was an underwriting unprofitable, a lack of underwriting profit, or some other reason. And in these cases, so it really is an oligopoly, right? So you had this cartel, is the right word for it, actually. So you have this price fixing that's going on, and they're all in agreement, they're all in cahoots, and they're having a great time, and life is easy. And you have a similar dynamic emerging with the mega personalized carriers, the standard lines carriers, where you have not as much competition, because there are only so many of them, and prices are pretty constant because they're all implementing the same kind of algorithms for the most part, right? And nobody else is allowed in because the barrier to entry is you need the data, you need the systems, you need the expertise to evaluate that data. You need to compete against people like you know, a Geico, like you're saying. And you just can't really do that. And so it's probably not cozy because they're competing still, but it's not the same thing as these crazy cycles you might get in other environments where you have a lot more flow in and out of the marketplace like you would have in, I don't want to say commercial auto because I think that's another example we might get to in a minute, but another very cyclical line of business where you do have to fight against madness a little bit more because people can come in. They can turn up.
Absolutely, and I think D&O is probably the best example.
Okay.
D&O, you had the financial crisis, people left, and it was a very hard market. And now I don't know if there's someone who's not doing D&O at this point.
Yeah.
The market is crazy, so it's starting to harden.
Workers' comp is a good one.
Yeah,
right?
There you go.
That's one people come in and out of all the time, right?
But there's just now so many competitors in the D&O. They all came in when the market hardened, and now it's madness. The market is incredibly soft.
Yeah. Another thought I had to the idea of commercial auto is in some lines of business, they're perennially unprofitable. Often, sort of the bugbears of at least the reinsurance industry are these capital allocators, right? So I think, the part that the paper described capital providers as being kind of these lagging indicator, these sort of moving average of the last 5 years profitability, that was very resonated with me. If you have a track record, you get capital. If you don't, you don't. And in some lines of business, people just think you just can't make money. And there's I'm not saying it's a majority, but a significant plurality of capital providers out there just believe you just cannot make money in something like commercial automobile insurance. And the reason why is the way I would put it, actually, which is kind of corrupting a positive term in the financial markets, is liquidity. And in this case, liquidity of distribution. So it's easy to win business in non-standard auto and commercial auto because the customers are out there trying to find the cheapest price somehow, and they're looking for it. Whereas the illiquid lines of business are much more profitable. Now, that idea is consistent with the financial markets, but I think the reasoning is very different because when you have a highly liquid market, it's easy to get screwed because if your pricing is wrong, they're going to find out and they're going to fill you up with mispriced business in that line of business. What do you think?
No, yeah, that's definitely true. It's the adverse selection, right?
Adverse selection, right. That's the key word.
It's something you got to watch out for, and at Geico, on the personal auto side, it was something you only worried about in specific segments. But in the commercial auto side, I feel like it's a lot more. There's a lot more flow of mm-hmm. customers that are less loyal, like you said, more looking for that low price, and that can be a big problem.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that liquidity is there an equivalent idea in insurance to liquidity? Because liabilities aren't liquid, right? You can't get out of a policy once you write it.
Right. I think it's an interesting to try to draw a line between like policy retention and liquidity, considering like, oh, if you're willing to move, it's a liquid, mm-hmm. you're very liquid. it's I don't know where to go with the comparison, but it is interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think is kind of a fundamental determinant for whether a line of business, I'll put it differently, is there a structural reason in some lines of business whereby you think you can make more money than not? The paper makes this point, and which is kind of what I'm getting at in a long way, is some markets are more susceptible or more appealing to arbitrageurs than others. They actually, ironically, as the paper said, if I understand this right, they are actually a little bit wary of really, really highly volatile markets because it's just too easy for a position to run away on you for no good reason, right? So they kind of want to have obvious areas of profitability in easy to analyze lines of business. I mean, not so unreasonable. We probably come across all the time in insurance. Do you think is there kind of a framework for thinking about what is an appealing or unappealing market for arbitrageurs and insurance?
So yes, in the specialty insurance, it's going to be the same thing. It's depending on the risk appetite of the investors. If you're dealing in excess and reinsurance, you have very volatile results. As long as the investors are okay with that, it's not a big deal. As long as they understand the results,
yeah.
It really depends on in the insurance world what your investors are okay with. If they're not okay with those sort of volatile results, then you need to look at the more interesting things that are high frequency, low severity, getting into like professional lines where you're looking at like, you know, EPL, those type of lines where it's higher frequency. Not a lot of people do it. Maybe you can take advantage of that. But the whole idea of avoiding volatile results, it really just depends on your investors because there's a lot of opportunity in those lines as well, because if they don't want to get into it, then there's probably a lot of other investors who don't want to get into it.
How far back do you go in data? I have a number in my head. What's your number? How many years back can you go and reasonability to get an insight in the line of business?
So it depends. Things that involve like the financial markets, sure. I don't like to go back too far.
Okay. What's that?
It's probably like right now it's really tough because the market's so crazy. But like 3-4 years, I'm willing to go back. Things like employment practice liability, I'll go back 6-8 years. Okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Things like where you're looking at excess, that's really tough. I don't know if there is a number. It's just you have to kind of judge on where you're at right now because it's going to when you're doing excess, the layers that you're at, who you're insuring, the industries that you're in become very, very important. Mm. So just looking at your history, maybe you look at the history of the industry. But looking at just your history isn't going to be super helpful.
What's the underlying model there? So what's telling you this market go back 4, this market go back 8? What is the characteristic of those markets that makes that
consistency? If I'm seeing, you know, frequency staying pretty consistent across time, not large jumps, then I'm okay going back using a lot more data. Of course, the issue there is if it is consistent, then you don't really need a lot more data, right?
Yeah.
Where if it's very, very volatile, it gets tougher to rely on the history, which I know is sort of counterintuitive.
It is,
right?
Isn't it? Isn't it?
But if it's volatile, it means that you probably can't trust your history as much. So you got to do a little bit more digging in and trying to figure out, you know, maybe you can break it into smaller segments, looking at, like I said, specifically into the industries and looking at the history there. But it gets tough.
Yeah. Yeah, the term of jargon there is non-stationary, right? So that means the underlying forces that are moving the prices around have changed, and they're not observed directly, but somehow the pattern, the pattern of price movement has changed. The characteristic, the behavior, if you want to use these kind of anthropomorphic kind of ideas, is changing, and so you can't rely on the older data. I mean, you nailed it, and I was just going for that too, as you mentioned it. But isn't it ironic that you the more volatile lines of business, you want to actually use less data, which you would think is making the volatility worse. But actually, the observation you're making there is there might be something else going on under the hood that we don't see.
Exactly. That's when you get into data modeling, right? You want to build some sort of model that can predict what's going on. Because if you're using your history, if you're using you have very volatile data and you're using a long history and it's performed really well for 6 years and really poorly for 2 years, you're going to go, oh, well, everything's fine.
Yeah.
And that's not the reality, right? The reality is that's probably not good history to use. You need to going forward, you need to figure out what's happening and why are we seeing these results.
Yeah. It seems to me that the returns always converge to some kind of market equilibrium return, call it whatever whatever the, who knows what drives capital returns? I mean, I don't know. And that's one of the things that frustrates me a little bit about the analysis of the softening markets and various lines of business, because you have a secular forces, that being non-observable, bigger than all of us, economic forces that are really pushing around what the real return you're going to, I think of returns as not actually under your control. The market's going to tell you what your return's going to be, and it's not really up to you to tell the market. You can pull your capital out, but the market, the return's going to stay the same. And so this is, you know, an idea which is maybe right, maybe wrong that I have. But ultimately, the returns you're going to get are, if they're dictated by the marketplace, then there is no such thing, as long as the marketplace is efficient. I suppose what I'm asking here is there an inefficiency that can persist in the marketplace? Because the market will just take it, right? People move in, drop the prices.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that could certainly happen. There's where you're just always unprofitable. But I think at some point, I would think that people would start to pull out. Sort of like you're talking about with commercial auto, right? Like there's just an inefficiency there that's going to persist it can't persist forever, right? Because that would be an inefficient market.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? And unless, you know, I think sometimes there's this quote by, I don't know if I've ever used it on the show before, by a guy named Jim Barksdale, one of the founders of Netscape. And his quote is, there's only two ways to make money, bundling and unbundling. And I think of insurance sometimes, if there's a, it's common to criticize your competitors in this business, because for all the same reasons that it's difficult to determine the quality of an arbitrageur, because it's difficult to measure quality, difficult to measure expertise, and saying, are you right or are you wrong? And so you can poo-poo your competitor because you don't understand why they would do this for a certain price, and you think you know that's a bad price, and they won the business. And one of the unobserved facts or observed features of their business strategy is that they're bundling things you don't see. And so in the bundle of an underpriced auto policy is also a homeowner's policy and an umbrella policy and a few other things. And so they can afford to actually be really cheap on one line of business because they're making money on other lines of business. And so sometimes you can see, say, and I know, for example, or I've heard of, for example, umbrella business being called high excess business, being pretty profitable, but hard to get. And so what you do is you write a little bit of this lower layer, which is really, really hyper-competitive, and you're not going to make any money on that. It's a loss leader to gain access to this other book of business. And you might look like an idiot if somebody was only competing with you on that one line of business. But elsewhere is where you're making your money. And so I don't know how that fits into the arbitrage framework. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're getting access to a marketplace that you wouldn't otherwise get, which is consistently profitable.
Yeah, I could say I don't know if this fits in the arbitrage, but that's definitely something that happens pretty often where it's again valuing that relationship. You're participating on one spot to get access to the other. You're leveraging that relationship. That's one of the key things in specialty insurance.
Yeah, it's interesting. And does that fit anywhere in arbitrage? I mean, relationships, that's such a fundamental part of what we do. I sometimes call insurance a moral economy, which is all about relationships and doing favors for each other and all above board, or maybe not always above board. But I don't know that it makes sense to analyze relationships in the context of arbitrage.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't work because the other party in arbitrage is the market, right?
Yeah.
That's all you're interacting with. It doesn't matter who's on the other side of that purchase.
Yeah.
So it's definitely where the comparison diverges.
And relationships are constrained, right? So let's say that you're a gatekeeper for a really, really profitable marketplace. The market wants to get in there to wipe out those profits, but you're not letting them in. And in a broader kind of many-to-many relationship market, there's an unlimited amount of capital which can get pointed at a particular problem. But where you have to go through this relationship, such a gatekeeper can only have so many friends, right? I mean, I found that your calendar fills up. You can only go for so many drinks. You can only allow so many people in through the gate. And so that preserves a profitable market from, you know, from the forces that you know move around your, you know, common stock prices.
Right, and I think this gets into one of the reasons why when the market's hardening, you really need to go hard into that market as a specialty insurer. You don't want to be too...
Because the window's open.
Right, the window's open,
right.
And you can get those relationships and get those intangibles. You're getting knowledge, you're getting data, you're getting the relationships. And all of those are extremely key when the market does start to soften, that you still have the relationships to get the business that's maybe going to perform a little bit better.
Yeah.
You have the data to try to piece out which ones are the better ones. You have the staff and the human capital to kind of understand a lot of that. And I think that's one of the key things for specialty insurers is that when that market's hard, you need to grow and you need to take advantage of it. The downside, the risk of that is if you're wrong, then you just grew whole, you know, very quickly in a line that's still going to keep taking losses and maybe continue to hopefully continue to harden. But there's definitely a risk to that.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways I like to think of whenever I have a conversation about relationships as they are presented in business, I like to substitute relationships for corruption. Because in some, just for fun, I suppose, because in some countries in the world, not all of them are as open or as law-abiding as ours, but a relationship, why it's called this gatekeeper, would be somebody saying, you pay me off, and I'll let you in. And that's corruption, right? So relationship is a form of, it's non-market behavioral constraint, right? So it's saying you are or trading constraint, rather, you are or not allowed to get in there, but you can't pay in or out. And so it's a disequilibrium in the market, and there's going to be rent seeking, to use the economic term, for getting in and out. And I wonder what you think of the idea of specialty insurance, or to call it the idea of the window being open. The underlying model there is actually one of a kind of corruption, where people are looking to get to extract some kind of value in order to let people in to access those profitable opportunities. What do you think about that?
I'm sure that's part of it, right? You're I mean, that's sort of the idea of brokerage, right? You're trying to,
sure,
you're getting paid to get that access. It's definitely a bit more above board than just sliding somebody some money. But the idea is that you're getting paid for that relationship. You have the relationships that the insurer wants to get to.
So we're running out of time. And I'm wondering if we could close on anything in particular that you think that you, any observations you haven't made yet about what you do or do not like about arbitrage as it is extended to include specialty companies. Is what's your final assessment? Does it work? Is it how strong is it an explanatory force?
So in relation to arbitrage relating to specialty insurance, yeah. I mean, so yeah, I think the correlation is very strong. Mm-hmm. I think that knowledge gap is key, right? That gap between what the arbitragers know and what the investors know. I think that's one of the key relationships. The idea of the market cycle being driven by that performance-based allocation of capital, I think that's a high correlation right there, right? Because they're using the historic experience of a line of business to decide where you're going to go into capital. I think that's what's driving it. As far as what can I actually pull from it, what can be useful, it's kind of tough. It helps me at least put a framework around this and kind of mm-hmm. think about some things. It potentially opens up more papers that I can read. I'm probably going to try to dig up some papers on capital allocation for arbitrages and see if it correlates, if I can find some more relationships there. But it's an interesting relationship.
It is indeed. My guest today is Rich Durr. Rich, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.